During the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep me and my family hydrated and refreshed. It really is sourced from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. As the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium water bottle brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330-milliliter and 500-milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water. It's Fiji water.
Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dress Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast that explores the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, Cassidy Zachary
and April Callahan. Dress listeners, Cass and I have to admit we have been so busy bringing you new original content and also interviews with many of the amazing authors and makers who have new projects out in the world currently that we have not really been keeping you abreast on all the latest afoot in the world of fashion history now. And that's what we're going to do today.
Yes, but first, happy Pride, everyone.
Cass, I think you're going to double down on this and say it's Pride every day on Dressed, but I don't really talk about this too often. It's come up here and there, but I am myself a member of the LGBTQ+ community. So it literally is Pride every day on
Yes,
Dressed.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what I was going to say, because, of course, we are a podcast about fashion and beauty, history and culture, which arguably would not exist without the contributions of our queer fashion history makers, movers and shakers historically and, of course, today. And Dress listeners, if you do want some Pride specific content, you can visit some of our past episodes. April, you actually did a fantastic episode, a mini-sode many years ago at this point, on the history of the Pride flag.
Yeah, and I didn't know that detailed history until I started researching it. So that was kind of one of my, you know, I don't know, fun research-based episodes that I've ever done. Tune back into that.
Yeah, and something that I will say right off the bat before I revisit some of our other past episodes is that something that we are remiss in doing, but it's not because we haven't tried to do it, but we still very much need to do it.
History of drag.
History of drag culture, and also the history of ballroom culture. And of course, we talked about it in the context of the documentary Paris is Burning. I do have an episode with the creator coming out. It'll be more in the fall, but with the creator behind the Black Beauty Archive, at Camille Lawrence, and she actually has also promised to put me in contact with historians of ball culture because she herself is part of a house. So that is very, very exciting coming down the pipeline. But of course, we've covered so many designers, like gay designers like Givenchy, Dior, Charles James. Some of my particular favorite interviews have been about how queer identity shapes and defines culture. Mm-hmm. So our listeners might remember our two-part interview with non-binary poet, performance artist, and activist, and historian.
And comedian.
Yes, Alok Vadmenon. And we did a two-part episode with them, Degendered Fashion, Past, Present, Future. Quite the historian and scholar themselves. Mm-hmm. And they joined us to discuss the history of sartorial gender codes, but also legislation and the non-gender conforming individuals who have dared to defy those regulations and laws historically. And then part two of that episode was possibly one of my most memorable of all time, because we just had the most beautiful and moving conversation about moving beyond the gender binary and why it's important. And then just also about radical self-love and the beauty of that.
Yes, yes, yes. And speaking of gender, of course, you could also tune back into our two-part episode on gender-bending fashion with Michelle Tolini-Fenimore. That must have been right before the pandemic, 2019, I think, perhaps. And speaking of drag, of course, our interview with Zaldi. And if
yes.
those of you who do not know exactly who Zaldi is, you probably already do if you are a RuPaul fan, because Zaldi has pretty much been responsible for each and every of Ru's looks over like the last 20 plus years or something like right?
Yes. Yeah. Incredible. And that was such a fun interview many years ago at this point too, which is just bananas. And then we've done Fashion Lovers, Dorothy Todd and Madge Garland. So Dorothy Todd was an editor of British Vogue in the 20s, and the fashion editor Madge Garland was her lover and partner. And they really transformed British Vogue into this forum for artists, writers, and other luminaries of the modernist and queer avant-garde. That was an excellent episode. If I do say so myself, I guess I wrote that.
Fine. You can give compliments to yourself on dress.
And then we also did Charity and Sylvia, a same-sex marriage in early America with Rachel Hope Cleaves. That was a fascinating book because she joined us to discuss the incredible 44-year love story of Taylor's Charity Bryant and Sylvia Drake, who were recognized and respected, April, as a married couple in their small, close-knit community of Weybridge, Vermont, in the early 19th century.
We've been here the whole time, friend.
Exactly. And this is actually segueing into my first topic today, because we've done interviews with two of my favorite queer fashion artists, who are Jordan Roth and Michael Sylvan Robinson. So Jordan, of course, is very familiar to many of our listeners because we talk about him and his fashion all the time, especially in the context of the Met Gala, one of the most exciting fashion figures, haute couture collectors, visual artists out there today.
And dress listener, too.
Yes. And dress guest, because he joined us in 2022 to talk about the art and beauty of the fashion self. And of course, as I said, we've been talking about Jordan's clothes expressions since 2019, because he first came on at least my radar after wearing a custom Iris Van Herpen cape to the 2019 Met Gala. This still is one of the most awe-inspiring moments in the history of fashion for me, because it was this cape that it was like a closed curtain. And then when he opened his arms, the theater revealed itself, the curtain opened. It was insane. So that lives rent-free in my head, as well as many of his other sartorial stylings, including his coat of many colors that was created in collaboration with textile artist, queer activist, past dress guest, Michael Sylvan Robinson for the 2021 Met Gala. And that accompanied the exhibition In America, A Lexicon of Fashion. So Michael actually joined us the same year as Jordan to discuss their thought-provoking textiles and artistic oeuvre, which spans decades and explores the intersection of textile and dress with this broad range of themes from identity, gender, sexuality, to violence, protest, and healing. And they do it all through this like these incredibly beautiful, colorful collage textile dress pieces. And that includes this collage coat that Michael made for Jordan. And Jordan actually commissioned it from Michael after he found out about the exhibition theme. And Jordan actually told Vogue, "When I knew about the exhibition, what it would be exploring, I immediately went to the idea of identity and how, for me, identity is a construction, just as a garment is a construction." And of course, we've talked about this coat because that was one of the exceptional pieces of the Met Gala that year. And dress listeners, April, because you live in New York, you are in for a treat because it's on view at New York City's Museum of Art and Design. And if you go to the exhibition website, Identity Is was created for multifaceted creator, tastemaker, and theater impresario Jordan Roth to wear at the 2021 Met Gala, a maximalist composition in which identity is a multifaceted creative act. The coat and its sweeping train are crafted from a textile collage of elaborately patterned fabric overworked with labor-intensive machine and hand-stitched beadwork. Layers of queer imagery and poetic text fragments are key elements in the work of artist Michael Sylvan Robinson, who says, "Name intentions often reminders of the fragility of our world and provoke a call to healing, to action, to remembrance." So if you are in New York, I could not find out how long it is on view, but surely through the summer, definitely check it out.
Yes. And you know what? I'm just going to tease a little exhibition that I'm supposed to go see in the next couple days that I'm sure will pop up on Dressed. But let's just say that it has something to do with some of the textile arts that have been produced in the past, kind of like in a art pauvre context in mental institutions. This promises to be quite interesting. So I will review that when we get back.
And let's just say that that is actually a segue into our two-part episode next week, Dress Listeners, which is on embroidery and incarceration. So stay tuned.
Yeah, lots more on that. Okay, so changing the subject a bit, my first item is not just for our listeners, but it's also for you, Cass, because some of you might recall that when the Barbie movie came out last summer, Cassidy did this really multi-episode deep dive into Barbie's own rather extensive fashion history. And that is because so many designers have contributed their own designs to Barbie's now 65-year-old closet, including the House of Dior, Karl Lagerfeld, Givenchy, Bob Mackie did a ton of Barbie looks. Jean-Paul Gaultier gave Barbie that iconic cone bra at one point. Diane von Furstenberg's wrap dress. I mean, we could be here all day. So one of their latest fashion house collaborations I'm very excited about this past February, in honor of Black History Month, Barbie and the brand Cross Colors announced that they would have an upcoming collaboration for Barbie. And for any of our listeners that might not necessarily be American or hip-hop fans, Cross Colors is an American fashion brand which was started by Carl Jones and TJ Walker, who originally had met when they were designing for a West Coast surf brand. And they did a little trip to New York, and they were kind of like maybe thinking about starting their own line. And one day they were riding the subway, and this was in the late 80s. I think it's like 1989 or so. And they realized there's all this amazing kind of like street style that was based around the hip hop scene in New York. So they were like, you know what? This is all coming from the underground. What if we started an official hip hop fashion line? And this was a relatively untapped market at the time. So as the LA Weekly has noted, quote, Cross Colors positions itself as a voice of urban youth with clothing that was fashion forward and community oriented. I actually have a little bit, it's not an extensive collection, but I have a small collection of vintage Cross Color t-shirts. When I find them, I buy them from the 90s. I'm very excited about this collaboration. I think that you will be too, Cass, because you are a fan of all things Barbie, especially Barbie fashion.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And actually, Dress Listeners, as you know, if you've been listening to the podcast, we don't talk about what we're going to talk about on these FHNs with each other. It just so happens that that topic segues perfectly into my next topic, April.
Oh.
Which is the Black Barbie documentary that is coming out.
Oh. We do this so often. We're like on the same page. Yeah. And it goes without saying that within this Cross Colors collaboration, all the Barbies are Black. And there's three of them, two female dolls, one male doll. They're decked out. The Cross Colors founders, they said, these dolls are the flyest. Our brand stands for clothing without prejudice, which means diversity, inclusion, and we can't think of any better way to amplify our message than through this collaboration. So add three more Black Barbies to that list.
Yes, exactly. And a direct extension of the groundbreaking work that has been done by very specific women at Mattel, and that are the topic and subject of this documentary, which you heard me briefly mention and briefly talk about in that Barbie episode, which aired last summer. At that time, the documentary had just come out at South by Southwest. I could not see it. I still have not seen it. But it has since received many awards and critical acclaim, and very excited to announce that it's making its debut on Juneteenth, which is June 19th, 2024, as part of the Shonda Rhimes universe at Netflix, part of the Shondaland production team. And we're going to listen into the film's trailer now.
You've gone your whole life and you've never seen anything made in your own image. There is damage done.
I'm a Barbie girl in a Barbie world.
When I think of Barbie, I see a little white doll with blue eyes in all pink. That's what I think.
I just found Barbie to be a little light-skinned.
Years ago, there were no black dolls. They were all white dolls.
The little white girls, they could see possibility in their Barbies.
And there was nothing that I could relate to. This is me and the creator of Barbie. At Mattel, I worked on the lines. She would say, do you have any suggestions? I was able to say, we want a black Barbie.
That was a little act of revolution.
Crowning this doll as Barbie was telling the world black is beautiful too.
I'm a black magic girl.
I designed black Barbie to reflect the total look of a black woman. She's black, she's beautiful, she's dynamite.
I thought Black Barbie felt magical.
From a young age, children can learn about inclusiveness.
Really pretty as looks, just like me.
Black Barbie was just taking me to a whole different world.
I knew Black Barbie was different, but I never realized the magnitude.
When did you first fall in love with Black Barbie?
When I first got one in my hand.
Okay, so that is very exciting now that we've listened to the trailer and just a little bit more about this film. So it's directed by LaGuardia Davis, and the documentary tells the story of the seismic impact of Black Barbie, who made her debut in 1980, as well as the three Black women responsible for her creation and success. You may remember from the Barbie episodes, Dress listeners, that the origin of Black Barbie actually goes back years or decades prior to 1980, to 1960, and this is when Mattel factory employee Beulah Mae Mitchell made the request of Barbie creator and Mattel founder Ruth Handler. She asked her for a Black Barbie. And Ruth Handler replied, we'll see. And it would be another 8 years before this request was fulfilled, kind of, with the debut in 1968 of Barbie's friend, Christy. So she's Barbie's friend. She's still not Barbie. So the proper Black Barbie would come in 1980 via one Luvinia Kitty Black Perkins, who, when she was hired in 1976 at Mattel, was the first Black fashion designer to design for Barbie ever. And she is the woman responsible for designing the first Black Barbie. And this documentary is exciting because it features interviews with Beulah, who was a Mattel employee for 45 years. It features interviews with Luvinia Kitty Black Perkins, who I desperately tried to get on the show, but I could not get in contact with her. And it also features continuing in the lineage of designers, Black designers at Barbie, an interview with Stacey McBride Irby, who was a project designer for Mattel for 15 years and was the creator of the Sew in Style line of African-American Barbie dolls. So again, what you were talking about, April, is that part of this long lineage, right? Yeah. And evolution and revolution of Barbie at the hand
which
of Black creators.
Today.
Yes, to this very exactly. Day. And Black Barbie is really groundbreaking and important for a number of reasons, including the fact that, of course, she's designed by Black creatives and something that, as we continue to know today, is really instrumental in ensuring authentic and respectful representation, and something you're going to learn all about when you watch this film.
Yes, yes. And you know what? This sparked an idea. Maybe we should do a dressed film night and everybody can watch it together on Netflix or, you know, do your own thing, watch it on Netflix, and then maybe have a meet and greet discussion afterwards.
Yes,
I don't know.
That would be so fun.
Yeah, if you guys want that, let us know. We are happy to do that.
Yeah, and how, if you have any suggestions about how to do it, because I looked into doing that as part of my class that's coming up, What Women Wore to the Revolution. Dress listeners, does have a book club, but not a film club element, because I could not figure out a way to do that en masse.
Oh, I think everybody just watches it on their own Netflix account. We just all come together and then discuss.
Oh, okay.
I've done some film things like that before in the past.
Okay. But before we move on from Netflix, April, you and I have not yet discussed Bridgerton season 3.
Well, the first half of Bridgerton season 3.
Which is, I think, tomorrow, actually, when this episode comes out, it will have aired. I may or may not have binged it. But I'm just curious, have you watched it? What are your thoughts? It has a new costume designer, new showrunner.
Absolutely. I watched all of the episodes within like a day.
As we all did.
And I did it in kind of a very fun way. My building has a movie theater in it that's available for tenants to like, you just book it and the movie theater is yours. You can go in there and watch whatever you want. And I did not invite any of my friends. I went into the movie theater And I watched it all by myself in my recliner, all reclined out and just jamming on my Bridgerton. It was amazing. I think it's great. I don't see a ton of difference in terms of there being a different showrunner. It still feels the same to me. The costumes, as always, are incredible. And if not, maybe they haven't even turned the volume up
a little bit. They definitely have turned the volume up.
They're a little more wild, especially the queen's wigs. And yeah, no, I think it's just really wonderful. And I love what they've done with Penelope. They gave her a little bit of like a slight makeover because now she is the leading love interest. I think they darkened her hair.
They did. Absolutely.
And she's wearing it down now versus up. But I've also seen some interviews with her at press junkets and stuff. And she's very, very funny. The actress plays her.
Well, she's, I don't know if you ever watched that Netflix show Derby Girls. Did you ever watch that? That's what she was. It's really funny. But yeah, I'm really enjoying it as well. So actually, this is the third costume designer in the run of the show. Which I can't speculate about why there's a turnover. My guess is it's a tremendous amount of work creating
it's
all of these
costumes.
Thousands. And it's remarkable. So of course we did an interview with the season one costume designer, Ellen Moroshnik, quite a Hollywood designer with tons of movies under her belt. Season two was Sophie Canale. And season three is John Glazer, who I believe was the assistant on both the first seasons. He told Vogue magazine in an interview, for the first season, we threw everything but this kitchen sink at it because we had to define the characters very quickly. So it was broad strokes and distinct color palettes. For season two, the costumes were a little bolder in color and more period correct. And this season, because of the story we're telling, we thought, let's make it softer. It's more textural, a little more blurry. We layered fabrics, for instance. We take a warmer color and a cooler color and combine them. I don't know, though.
Charles James trick.
Yes. I don't know if I would describe it as softer, though. I think that's an interesting, definitely textural, because I think especially with Cressida's outfits, they are out there this season. Mm-hmm. Very sculptural, very fun, very playful. But I don't know about soft.
No, I wouldn't say that either. And then they've definitely put Penelope in more jewel tones,
yes,
too, which complement her red hair.
So, yeah, yeah.
And no, then, I'm a big fan. I can't wait for the next to come out. I'll be back in the movie theater. Don't call me.
Yeah. And then, of course, Queen Charlotte's wigs, which have become their own character in the film. But I think it's really interesting, too, because they're by hair and makeup designer Erica Uckfitz. People are always talking about how crazy and out there they are, but they actually have a lot of historical precedent, as we know, in the poof hairstyles of the era. So as much as people want to talk about how this is high fantasy, which it is, there is still some historical precedent, and that's really how they tie it in and keep it believable in this world, is through real historical silhouettes. And then my last thing I'm going to say on this is, have you been watching the Bridgerton wedding?
I think that's like a little thing that they're doing on Instagram, right?
Yes.
I think I've seen one of them.
Yes. So, dress listeners, you have to watch this on Instagram. Tiffany Ray and Shanti Hinton, real-life Bridgerton fans, are getting a real-life Bridgerton wedding. It's all playing out on the Bridgerton Netflix account. You have to check it out.
And also just in time for Pride, which is great, too. Dress listeners, we're going to take a short sponsor break here, but more fashion history now when we come back. Dress listeners, whatever your reason for wanting to learn a new language, whether it's an upcoming international adventure, communicating with your friends and family abroad, or even professional purposes, Rosetta Stone has got you covered.
As the trusted expert in language learning for 30 years now, you can join millions of Rosetta Stone users to learn any of the 25 languages offered. That includes Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, and so many more.
And this is fast language acquisition, friends. There are no English translations, so you learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. And right now, you can get lifetime access to all 25 of Rosetta Stone's language courses for 50% off. That's language learning for 25 languages for the rest of your life, which, Cass, is frankly amazing.
It is. And what are you waiting for, Dress listeners? Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Dress listeners, did you know that you can save on everything from fashion to beauty, home decor to groceries, even kids' school supplies with Rakuten?
Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. Beauty, clothing, electronics, home, department stores, pets, you name it. You're already shopping at your favorite stores, so why not be saving while doing it? It really is a no-brainer.
How does it work, you ask? Well, stores pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members. You get paid via a check or PayPal quarterly.
Membership is free and it's easy to sign up. So join the 17 million members who have already saved at their favorite brands. Start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up. That's Rakuten.com. Dress listeners, are you not feeling like yourself these days? Do you suspect it might be related to some of the hormonal changes all women experience? Well, then Hormone Harmony is here for you. Hormone Harmony capsules contain science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows.
So whether you find yourself in menopause, perimenopause, or simply experiencing racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep, and feeling tired all the time, or even a low sex drive, Hormone Harmony is here to get you feeling like yourself again.
For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
All right, welcome back. I'm going to move us away entirely from the realm of fantasy and Bridgerton and move us into some fantastical, real-life fashion that might blow your mind a little bit here. The next item that I want to talk about is something that we have talked about ever so briefly on the show before in terms of new technological innovations, and that is spider silk.
Yes.
If you have not happened to have heard when we've talked about it before, that's right. Those sticky strands that, depending on your constitution, either menace you or mesmerize you, have actually, for the last decade or so, been the subject of scientific study. And that, in part, is due to their tensile strength, which those strings, for that amount of, you know, material, their tensile strength is 5 times that of steel. So the commercial applications of spider silk are virtually endless, which is why companies are now exploring spider silk's use in, you know, engineering applications, medical applications, and in fashion. So how does this work? Basically, scientists have figured out how to replicate spider silk's proteins, and they can isolate those and then reproduce them in the lab synthetically. And then using a liquid to spun fiber process, which is very, very similar to how rayon is produced from liquefied cotton proteins. It's shot through like a spinneret to create the thread. So think of a liquid coming out of your shower head. That's how we get the strands. So that's the same process of how they're doing artificial spider silk. But labs are able to now replicate spider silk alternatives for use as fashion fibers. So in recent years, we have seen a few different people using them in sustainable collections because this is a sustainable technology. Stella McCartney has used it multiple times. North Face. And also the Japanese streetwear label Sakai. So if all of this sounds incredibly high tech, it is. But in reality, spider silk has actually been used in fashion for more than 3 centuries.
So cool.
So there is an exhibition that I want to tell you all about that's currently up right now at the Museum of Islamic Art in Doha, Qatar. And that is called Golden Spider Silk. And basically, this exhibition, which is rather small, it charts the histories of the, quote, fascinating players determined to harness this rarest of silks from the inception of the idea by the Frenchman François-Xavier Bon in 1709 to its modern-day creators, end quote. And what is in the exhibition? We have several historic manuscripts on the process of producing spider silk as fibers. And we also have three contemporary pieces of spider silk textiles. And the piece that I really wanted to talk about is the fourth piece in the exhibition. And it is this mind-boggling creation of not artificial spider silk. This is real spider silk, and it's a cape. And this project had a lot of different people working on it for years, but the kind of two head leaders of the project were Simon Pierce and Nicholas Godley. And basically, they undertook this mission to create a spider silk textile, spider silk garment from the golden orb spider silks. And these spiders produce this luminous thread that is basically the color of sunshine. So when they process it for use as a fashion fiber, it doesn't require any dye. And these particular spiders that they used are indigenous to Madagascar. They are found in other parts of the world as well, but they were working in Madagascar. And Pierre said of the cape, he said, quote, "There is no precedent for spider silk textiles on this scale, either for the technical complexity or for the quality of silk used." So we're going to post links to the exhibition's website so you can see these pieces for yourself. But again, one of the most extraordinary things about them is the color. It's almost like it's metallic. It almost like vibrates. It's so bright. And this cape that they made is a tour de force of patience, teamwork, craftsmanship. The exhibition's website tells us that the cape incorporates silk from 1.2 million spiders. It took more than 2 years to produce, including over 6,000 hours of embroidery. And the imagery that's embroidered on it tells the story of how the spider creates a world, the silken web, out of itself. The idea being enveloped in spider silk was the original inspiration for this garment of prestige, which might, in an imaginary world, have been made for an imperial or royal court, end quote. Some of our UK listeners may have actually seen this piece in person already, because it was on view in London at the V&A in 2012. And the V&A also notes the work of the embroiderers, or the head embroiderers who worked on this piece. Their names are Lanto Rizinathbindarabe, sorry if I mispronounced that, and Rondro Faravolona. And we're also going to post additional links to some videos of Pierce and Godley speaking about the process of collecting the spider silk from the wild. And we just want to emphasize here that no spiders were harmed in this process. They were actually foraged by about a team of 60 people every single day looking for the spiders.
That is remarkable.
Yeah.
And also not a job I would even remotely want. I'm terrified of spiders.
Yeah. And, well, they would take them and they would place them in a little enclosure, like spin their
unwind
silk.
Yeah.
They would spin their silk for about 20 to 25 minutes and then they were released back into the wild completely unharmed. So you're going to learn more about this process if you watch the video of the cape's creation, which we also see. It's really spectacular. And trust me, this is going to be the most interesting 7 minutes of your week if you click on our link in the show notes and watch this video. So,
yeah, and I definitely did have this bookmarked to talk about on an FHN. I did not have it bookmarked for today, but I'm really glad that you did because it is just exceptional. I was stopped in my tracks when it came up on my feed, and I am on their website right now. And something we also might want to mention is that this is actually a companion exhibition to another fashion exhibition at this museum. So if you are able to make it, it's a double hitter. Because there's an exhibition, Fashioning an Empire Textile from Safavid Iran. So this exhibition highlights the critical role that silk played during this period, which was 1501 to 1736 CE. And just a little blurb from the website, it says, "Silk, its complex manufacturing process and supple feel against the skin make it a valuable and highly prized luxury good. Since the 6th century CE, Iran has produced high quality silk widely appreciated and traded long distances. It is, however, during the reign of Iran's most prominent ruler in modern history, Shah Abbas I the Great, 1588 to 1629, that silk became a state-controlled industry. It boosted the country's economy by supplying both an eager internal demand and feeding a vigorous export market spanning England to Thailand. So this exhibition was actually born out of collaboration with the National Museum of Asian Art in D.C. and explores the development of the silk industry under Shah Abbas.
And who says that fashion isn't political? It is.
Yeah. And we have not done a silk-specific episode, but that
Silk
again
Road?
Is... Yes, we need to do a Silk Road episode. The V&A had an excellent silk exhibition a few years ago. I mean, there's just so many topics, so little time, but definitely check out these exhibits. And if you can't make it there, there's plenty of visual content for you to access digitally.
All right. So apparently I'm very into textiles today, listeners. I would like to talk about the work of Korean artist Choi So-young. And Cass, you know that before I became a fashion historian, I was a contemporary art gallerist for like 10 years almost. So art is also one of my great interests. And when art and fashion collide, as they often do, this is very thrilling for me. And that's why I was very excited to discover the work of Choi So-young a few months ago. I have to admit, I am a bit behind in learning about her work, as it seems that she was really garnering a ton of international attention around that same time when I left the art world. Have you seen her work before? Do you know who I'm talking about by any chance?
I do, but I don't know anything about her specifically.
Okay.
So do tell.
Yes, listeners, her work is amazing. She basically uses discarded garments and especially denim. She has a particular fondness for denim and using jeans to create these textural collages of urban landscapes and city scenes. They end up being just a little bit 3D because of the nature of using textiles and like a 2D type of artwork. And those textiles are mounted either on canvas, like a painting, or on panel. And sometimes she uses a limited amount of acrylic paint in her work as well. But I had to say, like, what are they? They're more like collages, right? And I'm going to quote the Asian Art Database here when I'm describing her work, because I think they did a really good job. They said, quote, her compositions formed from a medley of pockets, seams, and zips in conjunction with acrylic lay the foundations for alleyways, high-rises, and vistas. Like a game of Where's Wally, it becomes more and more rewarding what you can spot. A back pocket with creases like a river's wave, a bleached twill that reaches into the sky like a cloud-covered mountain, or simply a belt buckle balcony, resting static and unassuming in a dense Korean cityscape. By using the throwaways of one's world and some of the most polluting industries, So-young is aligning herself with the circular economy by giving new life to discarded items. And we love nothing more than this on Dressed. It has a little bit of everything. And her pieces are so beautiful. They're like endlessly enthralling. And apparently, I'm not the only one who feels this way, because in 2011, one of her pieces sold at auction. So this is not on the primary retail market. This is at auction at Christie's Hong Kong for more than $276,000.
Dang. Yeah. I was like, can we get something for work? No. But I mean, this is art. If you even look at them first, like your first glance at them, you don't notice that they're textiles.
Mm-mm.
It looks like a photograph,
yeah,
or a painting.
And a really
they're
good
incredible.
One, too. Also very interesting, again, Asian Art Database goes on to note that before she was 30, she had sold more than $2 million of her work on the auction market, an achievement that was only ever attained by the Chinese artist Gao Yu and Jean-Michel Basquiat.
Wow.
Yeah. So staggering success. And then all of a sudden, she seems to disappear from the art world. I think she's, as her so say, her work has come up on the auction market here and there in the last 10 years. But the latest contemporaneously produced press that I can find on her dates to 2013. So more than 10 years ago. She doesn't appear to have a current website. She doesn't appear to have a social media presence. And I consider myself to be a pretty competent internet sleuth. So I'm very curious about her. What happened to her? Did she stop making work? And we do have listeners in Korea.
So if any of you hear this and you happen to know more about her, let us know. If she's open to it, I would love to have her on the show to chat about her work because I think it's that fantastic.
Absolutely. I mean, Dress listeners, there's so much to discuss. Honestly, we have to limit ourselves because April and I would just keep talking and talking, and we bookmark so many things that we want to talk about and cannot possibly get to all of them. But I think today we've given you many interesting things to do, to read, to look at, to look up and explore. And that's really the point of these FHNs, is to inspire you to continue learning about fashion history and things that are really accessible to you today, which includes things like our upcoming fashion history tour of Paris, Dress listeners, which actually you only have...
That was a good segue, Cass.
You only have a couple more weeks to register for it if you want to join us in Paris for the second week, October 12th through the 19th. All of that information is on our website, dresshistory.com/tours. But there is unfortunately a deadline. So if we don't fill it up, we don't get at least 15 people in the next 2 weeks, then alas, we will not be able to move forward. So if you want to join us, please do. Please reach out to us. And please also consider signing up for What Women Wore to the Revolution class, 1930s to 1960s, which is starting June 23rd. Lots for you to do this summer related to the dress universe.
Yes. And just back on that Paris trip tip, we want to emphasize that this is the second week that we're trying to fill up. The first week is already sold out. That is happening. There are a number of people that have already signed up for the second week. We just need a handful more. So if you are on the fence about it, you're like, oh, I have time. It's not until October. No, that window of signing up and us making this trip go forward is closing in the next like 2 or 3 weeks. So sign up now. Fashion History Tours at the Met every Friday with me. 90-minute tour of the Met's permanent collection, where we check out 10 of the museum's most fashionable masterpieces. And you can learn more about that on our website, which is, of course, dressedhistory.com. And if you would like to reach out and write to us, you can also do that at hello@dressedhistory.com. You can also direct message us on Instagram @dressed_podcast, which is, of course, where you will find images and reels accompanying each week's episodes. And if you would like to find Instagram content specifically connected to this episode, check out the hashtag dressed373. That's #dressed373. Remember, as always, you can find an array of our favorite and podcast featured fashion history titles on our Dressed bookshelf. That's at bookshop.org. You will find a link to our bookshelf in the show notes, as well as a link to sign up for the exclusive content ad-free version of the show, which is just $3 a month. As always, thank you for your continued support. More Dress coming your way on Wednesday. Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dress Media.
During the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep me and my family hydrated and refreshed. It really is sourced from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. As the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium water bottle brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330-milliliter and 500-milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.